Welcome to the reading of the Quad Cities Times for Monday, the 8th of April, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett, and here's Carol with our first story.
Thank you, Jeff. And the top article in the local page, Kewanee man charged with murder. From Cambridge, Jose M. Valentin, 43, of Kewanee, has been charged with two counts of first-degree murder for the death of Jimmy Hollins II of Kewanee. A preliminary hearing for Valentin is scheduled for April 8th in Henry County Circuit Court. According to the charges filed in the Henry County Circuit Clerk's Office, Valentin allegedly discharged a Glock 32 a 357 handgun in the direction of Jimmy Hollins on or about March 24th, causing Hollins' death. If convicted, the charges carry a penalty of 45 years to life. According to the Kewanee Police Department Facebook page, Kewanee Police investigated the incident in collaboration with the Henry Mercer Investigative Task Force, comprised of Zone 2, Division of Criminal Investigation, of the Illinois State Police, as well as the Henry County Sheriff's Office, the Mercer County Sheriff's Office, and the Aledo Police Department, along with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Galva Police Department, the Stark County Sheriff's Office, and Illinois State Police Crime Scene Services. According to the Kewanee Police, the Henry County State Attorney's Office reviewed the information and evidence, and an arrest warrant for Valentin was issued on March 28th for two counts of murder. Later that evening, Valentin was located and apprehended by the North Riverside Police Department. Valentin is currently being held without bond. The state has filed a petition to deny pretrial release. And here is Jeff.
A man is facing drug trafficking charges. A Clinton County man is facing drug trafficking charges after he allegedly had hundreds of THC cartridges sent to him through the United Parcel Service. Christopher Glenn Pribble of Toronto is charged in Scott County District Court with two counts of possession with the intent to deliver a substance consisting of or containing marijuana, and two counts of violating Iowa's Drug Tax Stamp Act. Each of the charges is a Class D felony under Iowa law that carries a prison sentence of 5 years. According to the arrest affidavits filed by Scott County Sheriff Sergeant Greg Hill, on February 2nd, agents with the Scott County Sheriff's Department Special Operations Unit intercepted two packages being shipped through United Parcel Service, UPS. One of the packages contained 400 THC cartridges, while the other had 350 THC cartridges. Each of the cartridges contained 1 gram of THC. One of the packages was being mailed to an address in rural Davenport that turned out to be a vacant home. The other package was going to an address in New Liberty. Scott County Sheriff Tim Lane said the mail services are absolutely inundated with dope going through. A controlled delivery was made to the vacant home in rural Davenport, according to the affidavits. The next day, a neighbor called and told officials that a man was at the house looking for his package. The neighbor got the license plate of the man's vehicle and positively identified him as Pribble. A controlled delivery also was made to the house in New Liberty. The homeowner told officers the package was for Chris and that he, Chris, had other packages sent there. The homeowner allowed officers to look at text messages exchanged with Chris. Officers saw messages with Chris along with two photos of the Sheriff's Department's drone that had been used to surveil the property. The pictures contained a sentence from the homeowner, quote, "There is a white vehicle at the corner." Chris replied, "Definitely sounds like a cop kind of situation." The homeowner replied, "Yes, it does, and I'm going to leave the box outside for now if that's okay." There were also messages from January and February stating, "You have a package here." A warrant was issued for Pribble's arrest on Thursday, and he was taken into custody and booked into the Scott County Jail early Saturday. He was released from jail after posting a $5,000 cash-only bond. Pribble will make his first appearance at a later date on the charges in Scott County District Court. At that time, a judge will schedule a preliminary hearing. Carol?
And a Kewaunee man declared sexually violent. In Henry County Circuit Court on Friday, Judge Colby Hathaway ruled that James Jr., 35, originally of Kewaunee, should be declared sexually violent and remain in the custody of the Department of Human Services. With the ruling, James is to remain in custody until such time when he is no longer a sexually violent person. David Kalicki and Kelly Van Voorhis of the Illinois Attorney General's Office were the prosecuting attorneys during the March 7th bench trial. Bill Breedlove represented James. The judge found that the state had met the required provisions of the Sexually Violent Persons Act because James had committed sexually violent acts and that he does suffer from a mental disorder that makes it substantially probable that he will commit future acts of sexual violence. He noted the latter element, whether James suffers from a mental disorder, making it probable he'll commit future crimes, was the real issue in the case. He said the state had met the second element beyond a reasonable doubt. In making his ruling, the judge said he found the testimony of Dr. Robert Brucker, the clinical psychologist who testified for the state, to be more credible than the testimony of Dr. Nicole Hernandez, the sex offender evaluator who testified for the defense. Judge Hathaway said Hernandez's testimony that James lacks the ability to understand right and wrong was contradicted by the record. He said putting his wants above the rights of others. Brucker diagnosed James with four conditions: other specified personality disorder with antisocial traits, unspecified anxiety disorder, alcohol use disorder, and mild intellectual disability. He said James fell into the highest risk category, being well above average risk of committing sexual violence again. Hernandez's testimony was that James has autism. The judge also denied James's claim that the statute is unconstitutional as it applies to him. In 2009, James was convicted of two counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse involving a 3-year-old boy and a 2-year-old girl and sentenced to 180 days in jail. 7 days after his release, he was charged with unlawful loitering in a school zone, an unlawful presence in a school zone, and sentenced to 3 years in prison. In early 2013, he was charged with failure to register as a sex offender and sentenced to 4 years in prison. In 2017, he was convicted of indecent solicitation of a child and violating the sex offender registry after a Facebook exchange with a police officer who was posing as a 15-year-old girl. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison. He was transferred to the custody of the Department of Human Services at Rushville in 2020. Breedlove indicated he would be filing an appeal as James Appellate Counsel. Jeff, I'll hand it back to you.
Newsroom picks for Quad Cities Restaurant Week. Quad Cities Restaurant Week is upon us, and 108 restaurants will be participating across the Quad Cities. With so many choices, it can be hard to decide which spots to give a shot and what to order when you get there. So we thought, as the lunch-loving foodies that we are in the newsroom, we'd offer some recommendations. From Rapids City to Rock Island, Bettendorf to Muscatine, here are a few restaurant picks from across the newsroom. And while nobody can try it all, we're going to give it a try. So alongside our recommendations, each of us will also be pointing out a spot that we haven't dined at yet, but we're hoping to this week. Happy dining. Thomas Geyer. When I first arrived here in 1997, I found the Grinders and Spaghetti House on West Locust Street in Davenport, operated by Maroon Kalara and his family. The West Locust Street location was opened in 1987. The spaghetti dinner, along with the meatball and chicken sandwiches topped with spaghetti sauce and cheese, remain among my favorite meals. Want to try? After living in Texas for 20 years, I'm a huge fan of Mexican food and enjoy trying to find the perfect margarita. I've yet to try Cabos Cantina and Grill, too, in Davenport. Enchiladas and tamales are my favorite. Gannon Hennevold writes, I'll always have a soft spot for Lemongrass Cafe in Moline, a Thai restaurant with noodles to die for. I recommend the Pad Woon Sen, one of the first dishes I wrote about for Best Thing I Ate This Week. On the Iowa side of the river, I recommend the Tangled Wood in Bettendorf. Their Southern Comfort mac and cheese is delicious, and their outdoor patio will be perfect for next weekend's hopefully sunny weather. Want to try Coya's Cafe? As a huge fan of Mexican food, it's long overdue that I try this beloved spot in Moline. So what better week than this one? Grace Cunicott writes, there's nothing more comforting than a grilled cheese sandwich with super melty cheese and barbecue pork in the middle of it. This sandwich truly was a life changer at the Grilled Cheese Bar in the village of East Davenport. Was it messy? Yes, but it was truly delicious and takes a classic sandwich to the next level. A classic burger with fries from the Dirty Shirley in Rock Island also is a must. It's one of my go-to burger spots. Want to try Melly's Pancake House? I love breakfast food and could eat it any time of the day. Also, there's nothing breakfast food can't fix. Tom Lowy. Do you love burgers? Burgers and beer? Wings? Wings and beer? You probably love Max Tavern in downtown Davenport. If you haven't been there, your friends probably make fun of you. Speaking of wings, the very best shrimp po' boy and best soul food is found at Pee Wee's in Rock Island. If you're really bringing the hunger, try Pee Wee's Platter. Want to try? Located in downtown Davenport, the Garrison has a cool name. I pressed my nose against the window and the interior looks cool. The menu demands some cool cash, but the offerings sound delicious. Someday soon, I'm going to shake my pockets and have a steak. Gretchen Teske. I get to write about new businesses opening, but I often get to try their food. But the exception was the last time I was in Silvis, and I ordered the chicken pesto sandwich from Creative Pastry and Coffee, now Creative Cuisine. This baby was packed with chunks of rotisserie chicken, sun-dried tomatoes, a pesto that was just lightly spread, and hands down the best aioli I have ever had. I like to consider myself a cheese curd connoisseur, and that's why I'm here to tell you that Me and Billy is a front runner these days. They're light, they're fluffy, and staff don't look at you crazy when you ask for extra ranch. Plus, the atmosphere can't be beat with the windows that look out on downtown and make you think you're in a city much larger than Davenport. Want to try the Palace Tavern? Once again, I was driving to another story when I turned down an unassuming street in East Moline. I immediately noticed the brick building with black awnings, and once I saw the patio, it was game over. Perusing their Facebook page shows me I need to get there immediately and try every pizza combination they offer. Sarah Wood writes, Bayside Bistros, Po' Boys, and sweet potatoes would be among my top choices for my last meal on Earth. Although it's not Bayside, the restaurant's Rock Island building is well-designed, comfortable, and quiet enough to have a conversation with your date. Antonella's 2 is a must-eat at the Freight House. Giovanni's famous creamy garlic pizza? Yes, please. Want to try Celebration River Cruises, because who wouldn't want to try a boat ride buffet? Connor Wood writes, A day trip to the Quad Cities in 2021 unexpectedly introduced me to the St. Patrick's Society Grand Parade and Miss Fay Cafe, which is home to wonderful Thai iced tea and a great selection of dishes. It's the vegan summer rolls that stick out in my memory. Dead Poets Espresso is another early stop for me while in the process of moving here. Good coffee, a nice atmosphere, and drinks named for literal dead poets. Plenty of food options, too. Want to try? Latin American food goes well beyond Mexican fare, which is itself amazingly diverse. I'm looking forward to trying Restaurante Sabor Catracho, a Honduran place on 16th Street in Moline. Their menu looks like it has plenty to try across a few visits. And finally, Tom Martin writes, I'm fairly new to the Quad Cities cuisine, so there are many places I'd love to go. Of the places, mostly for lunch, I've been to, the Grilled Cheese Bar in the Village of East Davenport offers a can't-miss menu of sandwiches. My go-to there is the turkey bacon sandwich. I find myself thinking about it randomly throughout the days. I've only been to Me and Billy's once, but I still remember the burger I had there. We were greeted by a man who I assume was Billy and had a nice lunch. I enjoyed the comfortable, inviting atmosphere in downtown Davenport and that burger. Want to try? I'll shift from food to beverage for my want. I'm far from a beer snob, but I like to sample locally brewed beers. The place I want to go is Bent River Brewing Company in Moline. Sounds like they know what they're doing. Carol, are you hungry yet?
And another news article. Police investigate shooting and stabbing. Davenport police are investigating a stabbing that occurred late Saturday and a shots fired incident that occurred early on Sunday. Davenport police were sent to a home in the 1900 block of West 4th Street at 11:28 p.m. on Friday to investigate the report of a stabbing. The initial investigation indicates that two men who know one another got into an argument. Both ended up wounded and were taken to Genesis Medical Center, East Campus in Davenport, for treatment. Police did not release their conditions on Sunday. Police canvassed the area looking for businesses and homes with surveillance cameras that may have captured the incident. The investigation is continuing. At 1:50 a.m. on Saturday, police were sent to the North Alley in the 800 block of West 2nd Street to investigate a report of shots fired. The alley is located between West 2nd and West 3rd Streets. The alley offers access to several taverns and an apartment building. Police located and retrieved shell casings from the alley. Police did not confirm if there were any victims in the shooting. Jeff?
A House of Hawkeyes. Iowa fans show up by the thousands in Cleveland. The House of Blues in downtown Cleveland quickly became the House of Hawkeyes Sunday morning. The famous live music venue is typically closed on Sundays, but Hawkeye fans would hear nothing of it and had live music and excitement rolling by 10 a.m. Both floors of the bar were packed, and kids danced along the stage with only black and gold in sight. The Hawkeye Huddle, as the fans call themselves, was out in full force with the iClub, the university's official fan club, sponsoring the event for those in town for the Women's National Championship game between the Hawkeyes and top-ranked South Carolina. T-shirts, stickers, and the like were scattered about the tables inside the room. "It's an exciting thing to showcase," said University of Iowa President Barbara Wilson. Wilson had said she arrived in Cleveland on Thursday and had been attending every event she could, excited to show off the spirit of the Hawkeyes to the rest of the world. One thing she found most exciting, she said, was the number of kids in the room wearing black and gold. A few times she went over and took pictures with them, she said, capturing the moment for both herself and for them. "They are our future students, and I want them to remember this," she said. In the back of the room was an Eldridge father and son, Troy and Tristan Klaus, who were decked out in matching sequin-covered gold suits. Tristan, the younger Klaus, is a University of Iowa student and a big Hawkeye fan. The reason for the outfits, he said, was simple. "We like the attention." The pair made it onto the Jumbotron, and multiple TV stations throughout the weekend, he said. Troy went as far as to make sure he had shoes to match his jacket. Standing outside the venue was 11-year-old Emma Cooper from Findlay, Ohio, holding a sign that read, "I'm not a Swifty, I'm a Clarkie," a quote from Hawkeye guard Kate Martin. Further down the 4th Street was Jason Wolf of LaGrange, Illinois, who was strolling the street decked out in head-to-toe black and gold, complete with a headpiece and scepter. He calls himself the Hawkeye Pharaoh, and by the outfit, he nailed it. The walk to the arena was only a few blocks long, but with two powerhouse teams expected to battle it out, vendors were taking full advantage. Next to the crosswalk was a vendor with all Iowa gear, everything from hats to gloves to sweatshirts. A gander across this crosswalk took visitors to the other side of the street, where there was a South Carolina merch vendor who claimed their own territory. In between the arena and the parking deck, spectators poured into what was dubbed Tourney Town. Booths with Powerade, food, merch, and pop-up basketball hoops were scattered about. The championship trophy was on full display, and standing next to it was who many thought was Caitlin Clark. Her look-alike, Orly Mintz, sported Clark's signature ponytail, a 22 jersey, and posed with fans, getting a laugh out of it all. A New York State native, Mintz dressed up as Clark for a costume party and posted the video to social media. It didn't take long for it to go viral, considering the lore that surrounds Clark. Even 11-year-old Robbie Berkey of Western Springs, Illinois, jumped at the chance to be like Clark, minus the physical resemblance. Berkey held up a sign that read, "I used to play soccer, but now I hoop. Thanks to you, number 22. A cheer from the crowd directed her attention to the red carpet laid out in front of the arena, where the Hawkeyes walked in, waving at fans. Berkey quickly scrambled onto her dad's shoulders to get the best view. "I can see everything," she said, with a smile on her face. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And a little bit of world news. World leaders condemn Ecuador after embassy break-in. Quito, Ecuador is where this is from. The global condemnation of Ecuador's government for its decision to break into the Mexican embassy snowballed on Sunday, with more presidents and other leaders expressing disapproval, shock, and dismay. The criticism came as Mexico's ambassador and other personnel arrived in Mexico City on Sunday afternoon after departing Ecuador's capital, Quito, on a commercial flight. President Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador severed diplomatic ties with Ecuador immediately after Friday's raid, which international law experts, presidents, and diplomats have deemed a violation of long-established international accords. Police broke through the external doors of the Mexican embassy in Quito to arrest George Glass, who had been living there since December. He sought asylum after being indicted on corruption charges. Mexico plans to challenge the raid at the World Court in The Hague. In a statement on Sunday, the Spanish Foreign Ministry said, "The entry by force into the Embassy of Mexico in Quito constitutes a violation of the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. We call for respect between international law and harmony between Mexico and Ecuador. Brotherly countries to Spain and members of the Ibero-American community." A day earlier, the Organization of American States, in a statement, reminded its members, which include Ecuador and Mexico, of their obligation not to invoke norms of domestic laws to justify noncompliance with their international obligations. Jeff?
From the News Digest, officials say that Ukraine fired on a nuclear power plant. The head of the UN's Atomic Watchdog Agency on Sunday condemned a drone strike on one of six nuclear reactors at the Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, saying such attacks significantly increase the risk of a major nuclear accident. In a statement on the social media platform X, Rafael Mariano Grossi confirmed at least three direct hits against the ZNPP main reactor containment structures took place. "This cannot happen," he said. According to the plant authorities, there was no critical damage or casualties, and radiation levels at the plant were normal after the strike. Later on Sunday, however, Russian state-owned nuclear agency Rosatom said three people were wounded. A man is charged with setting fire near Sanders' office. A man was charged Sunday with setting fire outside the Vermont office of U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, federal prosecutors said. Shant Sogomonian, who was previously of Northridge, California, entered the building on Friday and went to Sanders' third-floor office, where security video showed him spraying a liquid on the door and setting it afire, officials said. The building's interior suffered some damage from the fire and sprinklers that doused the area with water, but no one was hurt. Sanders, an independent, was not in the office at the time. And an Eastern Pennsylvania man has been charged with involuntary manslaughter in the death of a 3-year-old boy who authorities say shot himself with a handgun left unattended last month. Jose Hilario Abreu, 28, of Allentown, was arraigned on Friday on the charge, as well as two counts of critical endangerment. And we have an obituary. Back to you, Carol.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. We have no obituaries today. We have one pending funeral. And this is for Daryl Lee Woodward, age 86, of Wilton, Iowa, who passed away on Saturday, April 6th, 2024, and Harmony Nursing Home in Davenport. Arrangements for Daryl Lee Woodward are pending at Bentley Funeral Home in Wilton. And now we will go to the opinion pages, and the top half of the page is a sketch by Phil Hands. I see a golf cart parked there, and standing outside beside it on the grass is this very obese gentleman who is leaning on his golf club, and he has a tee at his feet with a ball in it, and he's standing there with a bottle of something in his hand. They don't show us what it is, and he's puffing on a big old cigarette or cigar there. He looks amazingly like Donald Trump. And these articles, of course, there are two opinions. Well, the first one is entitled, oh, it's an answer. At the heading is golf a real sport? And the answer is not anymore because of cost and falling interest. And this one is written by Sam Pizzagatti, who is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. He last played a round of golf in 1964. And this is what Sam has to say. At my 16-year-old grandson's high school, students have to choose a different sport for gym class every semester. My grandson chose weightlifting last semester, and this semester he's playing chess. Chess? Does chess rate as a sport? Sports Illustrated says it does. Sports Illustrated once gave a cover to the young grandmaster Bobby Fischer, who never even had to break a sweat. In a sense, any competitive game can be a sport. But for a game to qualify as what we might call a real sport, the competition has to give every competitor at least one essential: a sporting chance to win. Sheer hard work, be it mental or physical, has to, at some point, really matter. And hard work does matter all across the real sports spectrum. Kids from the Dominican Republic with hand-me-down baseball gloves can wind up playing in a World Series. Soccer players from shantytowns in Sao Paulo can star in World Cups. Youngsters in Harlem can go from rusted rims to NBA All-Star games. Golf, for a brief moment, seemed headed that way. Born in a dirt floor shack, Lee Trevino quit school after seventh grade to caddy at a private Dallas country club. Between caddying tricks up and down fairways, Trevino honed his golfing skills on a makeshift three-hole course his Caddyshack buddies built. In 1968, Trevino would go on to win the U.S. Open. By then, golf had already outgrown some of its aristocratic pretensions. On Long Island's Nassau County, once a playground for New York's wealthiest, the ranks of golfers started swelling during the Great Depression as private courses went bankrupt and turned into quality public venues that working stiffs could afford to play and enjoy. My dad used to caddy at one of those private courses that went under. Dad and his fellow caddies chipped in, bought the course, and then went on to run it, open to the general public, for years. During those years, the golf-playing public was rapidly expanding. Between 1950 and 1970, one Texas A&M expert notes, the number of golfers in the United States more than tripled. But this mid-20th century mass golden age for golf didn't last. Our growing inequality didn't let it. In our contemporary golf scene, financial resources determine outcomes much more than in any other pastime that aspires to actual sport status. Are your drives not going far enough? To fix that, a golfer in days gone by had to practice on the driving range. Now, wealth buys easier options. You can spend $1,200 on a gilded driver that offers exalted performance for seasoned players with moderate swing speed. Do you have to pay $1,200 for a bat to hit a better baseball? In baseball, you don't need a different bat to bunt. In golf, you need 14 different clubs, and none of them are particularly cheap. The cost of clubs and other golfing essentials undoubtedly contributes to this century's shrinking number of golf courses. Since 2005, the National Golf Foundation reports that the number of America's 18-hole equivalent horses has sunk to 12%. Between 2002 and 2016, a smart asset analysis adds the number of Americans playing golf dropped 24%, a number that has continued to decline. The golfing industry, meanwhile, sees nothing but bright days ahead. Industry leaders love to point to the bottom in off-course forms of golf, such as the indoor entertainment centers that feature climate-controlled hitting bays paired with music and a full bar and kitchen. Everybody can swing away, have some laughs, and even get a little tipsy. Great fun for all, but it's not a sport. The golf that does claim sport status increasingly belongs only to those who can afford it. Does this golf have any future? It's hard to see where. As the Albany Law School's Ray Breska notes, local communities are coming under increasing pressure to take stock of the environmental harms golf courses cause and the tax subsidies they receive. So, let's remember that individual sports, over time, have always tended to come and go. Think jousting and bullfighting. Good old golf may well be going soon. And what do you think about that, Jeff?
I suspect I might agree with the second author, who is Carly Matthews, a communications professional in Washington, D.C., and a lifelong golf fan. She writes, "Of course it is, and so much more than that. The best golfers in the world will compete next weekend for the right to slide on the iconic green jacket of Augusta National for the Masters Tournament. It's a scene that's become infamous in sports. Yes, I said sports. What is a sport anyway? The Oxford Dictionary says a sport is an activity involving physical exertion and skill in which an individual or team competes against another or others for entertainment. Golf is a sport, not only because it meets the dictionary definition, but also because it is an integral part of our culture. All over the world, so many people, myself included, would find their weekends undeniably worse without golf. At its core, golf has the same goal as many other sports, getting a ball into a hole. Golf was born in Scotland before the 15th century. Fun fact, it was briefly banned in its home country because it was such a distraction for soldiers during the Anglo-Scotland Wars. In 1744, the first attempt to codify golf's rules was made, and over the next 100 years, golf clubs across the world adopted the 13 Articles. Since then, professional golf leagues, including the PGA Tour, formed worldwide. Most non-believers argue that golf doesn't require physical exertion or skill. It should be clarified that playing golf well requires both. Driving around in a golf cart while drinking a beer and shanking every shot is, well, that's not your problem, that's your problem, not a golf problem. Professional golfers spend hours in the gym, on the range, and putting green to perfect their game. Scottie Scheffler, the world's best golfer, released a training schedule ahead of last year's Masters that focused on endurance. Not only does playing 18 holes of golf require walking upward of 7 miles, which professional players do 4 times during a single tournament, but golf is a unique mental challenge. Reigning U.S. Open champion Wyndham Clark spoke about seeking sports psychologists on the most recent season of Full Swing. It's straightforward for professional golfers to get in their heads, and golf being a solo sport means no one comes to your rescue. It's just you and the course. Finally, it's impossible to classify golf as anything other than a sport because of its entertainment value. Golf is one of the most watched, popular sports worldwide with a distinct, dedicated fan base and unique culture, reaching 123 million people annually in the United States. I discovered the culture of golf going to tournaments with my dad as a kid. Nothing in the world is like Augusta National. I'll never forget the childlike excitement in my dad's eyes when we attended a practice round in 2010, when Phil Mickelson would ultimately shrug on his third green jacket. Everyone on the course seemed to understand they were part of something bigger, enthusiasm quieting to complete silence when a player stepped up to the tee, even during the practice round. I was only 12 at the time, but that day will forever live in my memory as one of the best days with my dad, the man who introduced me to the game of golf in our small Pennsylvania town and took me to the PGA and LPGA tournaments all over the East Coast. Lastly, in 2010, at the Women's U.S. Open at Oakmont, Pennsylvania, my dad and I briefly met golf's greatest icon, Arnold Palmer. Now, perhaps best known by non-golfers as a beverage, Palmer won 62 tournaments on the PGA Tour. Watching him sign autographs, my dad paused just long enough to garner his attention and exclaimed, "Hi, Mr. Palmer." That day was pure joy for my dad and me, especially since my favorite golfer, Paula Kramer, took home the hardware that Sunday. I could rattle off numbers all day about why golf is a sport, but the love of any sport is bigger than the words on a page. It's about the moments we share with ones we love, watching the best athletes in the world compete for a title. During the Masters, the biggest week in golf, I hope the sport allows kids like me all over the country to bond with their dads like I have with mine. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And guess what? Midwest League Baseball, Quad Cities 4, South Bend Zip. A trio of triples propel the Bandits. With a loss in Friday evening season opener, the Quad Cities River Bandits did not give themselves a chance to triple their fun in their three-game high-class A Midwest League season opening series. However, the Bandits did triple their pleasure on Sunday, using three triples to beat the South Bend Cubs for the second time in 2 days and take two of three games in the set at Modern Woodman Park. Out-hitting the Cubs 9-5, the River Bandits took the series finale 4-0 in front of a matinee crowd of 629 along the banks of the Mississippi River. The biggest of those three base knocks was delivered by leadoff batter Carson Rockefort. In the bottom of the sixth inning, his three-bagger drove in Justin Johnson and Davis Nadal to spark a three-run inning that ended the scoreless game. Rockefort then scored undesignated hitter Carter Jensen's RBI single that deflected off the glove of South Bend second baseman Pedro Ramirez as it found its way into right field. Quad City added an insurance run in the seventh when Jack Panada led off the frame with a triple and scored on a balk. Johnson, Panada, and Brett Squires each had two hits for the Bandits, who stranded 13 runners on base in the victory. Four Quad City pitchers combined to hand the Cubs their first shutout of the young season. Right-hander Henry Williams pitched five scoreless innings, giving up just one base hit. He walked four and struck out three. Left-hander Hunter Owen pitched a one-hit sixth inning and got his first win of the season, striking out two. Righty Chase Wallace followed with two innings of two-hit balls as he struck out three. Right-hander Ben Sears then closed out the game, allowing one hit and walking one as he fanned two. After a day off on Monday, Quad Cities opens a six-game set against West Michigan. And they are 1-2 in a 5:35 p.m. contest on Tuesday at IMCU Ballpark in Comstock, Michigan. Jeff?
In women's college basketball, the NCAA title game, South Carolina 87, Iowa 75. The Hawkeyes denied again. South Carolina ends the season undefeated and avenges the 2023 loss. Camila Cardoza delivered once again for Dawn Staley in South Carolina. A perfect finish, a dynasty, a team too big for Caitlin Clark in Iowa this time around. Cardoza had 15 points and a career-high 17 rebounds, and South Carolina completed its perfect season with an 87-75 victory over Clark and the Hawkeyes in the NCAA championship game on Sunday. With Staley directing a relentless attack from the sideline, the Gamecocks, who are 38-0, became the 10th Division I team to go through a season without a loss. And they accomplished the feat after they lost all five starters from last season's team that lost to Clark's squad in the national semifinals. When young people lock in and have a belief and have a trust, and their parents have that same trust, this is what can happen, Staley said. They made history. They etched their names on the history books. Clark did all she could to lead the Hawkeyes to their first championship. She scored 30 points, including a championship record 18 in the first quarter. She rewrote the record book at Iowa, whose record is 34-5, finishing as the career-leading scorer in NCAA Division I history with 3,951 points. She hopes her legacy isn't defined by falling short in two NCAA championship games, but more by the millions of new fans she helped bring into the game and the countless young girls and boys she inspired. I think the biggest thing is it's really hard to win these things. I think I know better than most people by now. To be so close twice really hurts, Clark said. As the final buzzer sounded, a stoic Clark walked off the court, through the confetti, and into the tunnel, heading to the locker room. I personally want to thank Caitlin Clark for lifting up our sport. She carried a heavy load for our sport, Staley said. She's going to lift that league, the WNBA, up as well. Caitlin Clark, if you're out there, you're one of the GOATs, greatest of all times, for our game. We appreciate you. South Carolina has won three titles in the past 8 years, including two of the past three, to lay claim to being the latest dynasty in women's basketball. Staley became the fifth coach to win at least three national championships, joining Gino Auriemma, Pat Summitt, Kim Mulkey, and Tara Vanderveer. The Gamecocks, who've won 109 of their past 112 games, became the first team since UConn in 2016 to go undefeated. South Carolina had a couple of scares throughout the season, but always found a way to win. With most of the team returning next year, Staley's team is in a good position to keep this run going. This team, we're going to be good. Coach Staley, we have the best coach, in the country, in the nation, in the whole wide world, Raven Johnson said. It's no telling what she is going to add to the pieces that we already have. I'd just say be on the lookout. Tessa Johnson led South Carolina with 19 points. Cardoso, the Final Four most outstanding player, also blocked three shots. Camila Cardoso was not going to let us lose a game in the NCAA tournament, Staley said. She played through an injury. She played like one of her top picks in the NBA draft, and her teammates did something that no teammates have done before. Somebody who went to the WNBA in our program. They sent her off as a national champion. So this is history for us. Led by the 6'7" Cardoso and Ashley Watkins, South Carolina enjoyed a 51-29 rebounding advantage. It also finished with 30 second chance points. The Gamecocks also showed off their impressive depth. Tessa Johnson helped the team to a 37-0 difference in points by reserves. South Carolina trailed 46-44 late in the second quarter before going on an 11-0 run spanning halftime to open a 55-46 advantage early in the third quarter. Clark finally ended the run with a layup. The Hawkeyes closed to 59-55 and had a chance to get even closer, but Hannah Stolke missed a wide-open layup on a brilliant pass from Clark. South Carolina responded with the next 8 points, including 2 3-pointers. The Gamecocks, who were 4-for-20 from behind the three-point line during last season's Final Four loss to Iowa, went 8-for-19 from deep against the Hawkeyes in this victory. Iowa was down 80-75 after a three-point play left by Sydney Afolter with 4:12 left, but the Hawkeyes were shut out the rest of the way. Clark checked out with 20 seconds left when Iowa coach Lisa Bluter subbed in fellow senior Molly Davis, who hadn't played since she got hurt in the regular season finale against Ohio State. Unlike the semifinals, when Clark struggled against UConn's defense, she got going early against South Carolina. Clark scored 13 straight points, including another logo three for Iowa as the Hawkeyes were up 11 early. South Carolina cut it to 22-20 with 1:30 left in the period before Clark scored the final 5 points, including a three-pointer over Cardoso. Clark's 18 points in the opening quarter set a championship game record, surpassing the 16 that Jasmine Carson of LSU had last year against the Hawkeyes. The Gamecocks trailed 46-44 in the final minute when Tiana Paopao hit a three-pointer and Raven Johnson stole the ball from Clark near midcourt and went in for a layup. South Carolina led 49-46 at the half. Carol?
And game sets record for wagering. Dateline Las Vegas. A history-making women's college basketball season ended with at least 3 sports books declaring Sunday's national championship as their most bet-on female sports event. Red Rock Las Vegas race and sportsbook director Chuck Esposito said the game not only eclipsed handle records, but also the number of betting tickets that were written on it. He said, "Game was on the main screen with audio at Red Rock, if that puts it into any perspective. Unbelievable interest from the viewing and betting public." Jay Cornegay, West Gates Executive Vice President of Race and Sports Operations, said, "South Carolina's 87-75 victory over Iowa to complete a perfect season for them nearly doubled the Hawkeyes' Elite Eight victory over LSU in terms of money bet." BetMGM posted on X, "This also was most wagered women's sports event. Sports betting records were expected to fall in what was a highly anticipated matchup of South Carolina trying to win its third title under coach Dawn Staley against Iowa and two-time AP Player of the Year Caitlin Clark. Clark's willingness and ability to take three-pointers seemed all over the court, made her a betting and TV rating magnet, drawing eyeballs to women's college basketball in record numbers. This was Clark's last game at Iowa. She is the overwhelming favorite to be the number one selection of the WNBA draft by the Indiana Fever." Jeff?
One moment here while I find my place, Carol. Pardon me. We'll finish up some sports about men's basketball for tonight. The 2023 champion UConn faces Purdue for the title, and opponents have shown they deserve this matchup. The NCAA tournament has reached its finish line, down to one game pairing the two best teams that routinely win in romps and boasting a marquee post matchup that features a two-time National Player of the Year. Maybe this will make this version of March Madness something to remember after all. Reigning champion UConn meets Purdue on Monday night in a matchup of top seeds that have combined to win their first 5 tournament games by an average margin of 22.3 points. They've been at the center of a tournament lacking in drama, with its second highest average margin of victory since the field expanded to 64 teams in 1985, only one last-second winning shot, and few of the highlight reel thrills that had become a staple of the event. Don't expect the Huskies or Boilermakers to feel the least bit bothered by their dominance either. People that love basketball and people really know how the game, or people really know the game, you watch good basketball, Purdue guard Fletcher Lawyer said on Sunday. Obviously, the upsets are fun and real cool and they get attention. But real basketball, you like to see the two best teams go at it. And I think that's what we have here. Well, that brings us to the end of the Quad Cities Times for today, Monday, the 8th of April, 2024. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockhart. You can listen to Irish programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.